Many of animal rights groups in the United States focus their attention on providing more humane circumstances for the farm animals and pets that have become integral to human survival.
Gary Francione, a professor of law and philosophy at Rutgers University, has become a prominent voice in the animal rights debate because he presents an alternate view. He argues that any system that treats animals as property is inherently immoral.
Professor Francione has been an advocate of his version of animal rights for almost 30 years and has published several works on the subject, including his newest work, Animals as Persons. Producer Andy Clegg recently spoke to him about his ideas.
Many years ago when I was in law school, I visited a slaughterhouse and saw what was going on there. It was quite shocking. I had never really thought about the issue in my entire life until that point. And a friend of mine who was a vegetarian took me to a slaughterhouse, and I saw it, and it provoked me into thinking about the issue. And I decided that I really couldn't participate in that anymore. So I gave up. I immediately stopped eating meat, all meat, beef, pork, poultry. And then, this is probably, Andy, going back to 1978 or so. It's a long time ago. And then I learned that fish were sentient and could feel pain, so I stopped eating them. And then I learned about the dairy industry and how horrible that was, so I gave up all animal products altogether and became a vegan by about 1982, I think.
What is your idea of animal rights? How should we treat animals, and why should we treat them that way?
Well, my view is a little bit different from what is commonly thought of as the animal rights view. I mean, first of all, let me say this. I don't really think that the law, even though I'm a law professor, that the law is going to be the primary mechanism that's going to address the problem. I think that, one of the themes of my work has been that animal welfare regulation, that is, laws and regulations which are supposed to ensure the humane treatment of animals, really just don't work. There are reasons for that, the most important of which is that animals are property, so they're economic. These protecting their interests costs money, and consumers and producers are not going to incur those sorts of costs, particularly given that markets are now such that even if they were to incur those costs, if the demand does not change, then the products just come in from other markets which are not regulated. That's a consequence of these free trade arrangements and whatnot. But my bottom line is that it's not the law. That I was doing an interview earlier and someone said, well, would you support legislation that prohibited the eating of meat? And the answer is, well, that would be crazy. It wouldn't work. I mean, it's like that would be probably even more unenforceable than prohibition it was. It's not the law that's going to lead here, Andy. It is our thinking morally about the issue. It's going to be a moral change, a moral paradigm shift that we are going to need to effect if we're going to make any progress in our thinking about this. And let me just throw a proposition out there. I've never in my whole life met anybody who disagrees with the proposition that it's wrong to inflict unnecessary suffering and death on animals. I mean, everybody agrees with that. Never met anybody disagrees with it. Now, we can have interesting discussions about what necessity means in various philosophical contexts. But if that norm means anything at all, it means we can't inflict suffering and death on animals, for reasons of pleasure, amusement, or convenience. We have a rule that says it's wrong to inflict unnecessary suffering and death, but it's all right to do it if we get pleasure, amusement, or convenience. We've now got an exception that is so large that it's rendered the moral principle to be meaningless. And so we all accept that. But yet, our eating of animals, I mean, most of our animal use, I would say the overwhelming portion of our animal use, can only be justified by pleasure, amusement, or convenience. Case in point, our eating of animals. We are killing 53 billion animals in this world every year for food, and that doesn't include fish and other aquatic animals. That's the UN figures on, basically beef, pork, chicken, rabbits, and whatnot. So we're talking about 53 billion animals a year. Now, we don't need to eat those animals. Indeed, an increasing number of mainstream healthcare people are now saying that eating animal products are detrimental for your health. You certainly don't need them.
If you don't think the law would work to discourage people from using animal products, what would be the catalyst that would need to happen for significant change to happen in how we think about the use of animals?
One of the things that, one of the experiences I've had that's really very interesting is I don't have any sort of organization. I mean, I'm just a professor at Rutgers, and I don't have any, I don't have an organization. I don't accept contributions or anything. I just do the work that I do, whether it's writing books or teaching classes or whatever. And I launched a website last year, www.abolitionistapproach.com. in which I argued that we really needed to rethink these issues and that the thing that we needed to do was to educate people about these issues and engage them in sensible, coherent, rational discussion about these issues and that and encourage them to become vegans. And that by doing that, we reduce demand. That's how you do it. You can't do it any other way. It doesn't work any other way because if you think about it, this is an important moral issue because it has to do with violence. And we all of us wear our moral high hats and say, you know, we don't like violence. And yet, we all participate in it three times a day, ritually, and don't even think about it. And, you know, if you live in a world where 53 billion animals are being killed every year, and the best justification we have is they taste good, it's not surprising that we have an awful lot of violence in the world and that people have become inured to it because it's part of our lives and we're not really even interested in getting rid of what we can get rid of. Neither you nor I can solve all the problems of the world, but we certainly can do things in our own lives to make statements about nonviolence, to say that we really do take it seriously. But I also think there are important health implications. Eating animal products is clearly not a good thing to do. I mean, everything that I read, and I read this stuff constantly, study after study that comes out that says that animal products create this disease or cause this disease or are involved in this sort of disease process and the environmental impact.
Ultimately, in your formulation, I mean, even if animal products were comparatively no less healthy than a vegan diet, and
right.
even if animal agriculture didn't have the environmental effects that it has, mm-hmm. you would say it'd still be more imperative to not eat or use animal products where they can be reasonably avoided.
Absolutely, Andy. Okay. Absolutely. No, if I said anything that suggested the contrary, let me correct it. No, absolutely. I think it's a moral imperative, and I don't think that the health issues are... I raise them because I think it's important to point out that not only is it a moral imperative, but there's no need for it from a health point of view. Indeed, there seems to be a problem with eating animal products,
right.
Number one. Number two, we are all concerned. I mean, we're all concerned about global warming. I find it comical that the media is sort of focused on the fact that, you know, well, is ethanol a good thing because it's causing grain prices to go up? And the answer is ethanol is a small part of that particular problem. The problem is animal agriculture, and the problem is that countries like China and India are exponentially increasing their consumption of meat, and that is caused, I mean, you know, it takes between 6 and 12 pounds of plant protein to produce flesh, to produce a pound of flesh. You know, it takes a lot more water. I mean, the conversion ratios are insane. I mean, it takes like, I think, 3.25 acres to support one omnivore for a year, where 20 vegans can be fed from an acre. So, I mean, you know, the resource issues are just stunning. But you're right. No, it's a moral imperative. We shouldn't be doing it.
Now, before you mention your approach is sort of an abolitionist approach, and when I was looking through your website before, mm-hmm. there's a lot of examples of you go through and take an argument that someone makes mm-hmm. for eating meat
yep.
and sort of apply that maybe to a human issue.
Yeah.
Like somebody says, well, eating meat is obviously, it's a very old human tradition. People have always eaten meat. And you said, sort of use slavery as an example, where tradition is no justification for enslaving human beings. To you, in your framework, what is the morally significant difference between a person and an animal, if there is any?
You mean a human person than an animal?
Yeah, human being.
Well, I mean, you know, if it's just an empirical question you're asking, the answer is there are clearly differences between human and non-human animals. The most significant of which is that we use language, we use symbolic communication, and our concepts, our conceptual structures, are very, very much linked to that language. And so I suspect, I don't know, because I can't get into the minds of other animals, I can't get into your mind either, but I mean, I suspect it's somewhat similar to mine and that we think in somewhat similar ways in terms of our conceptual structures. But now, I don't know what goes on in the mind of a dog. It is clear, given that, you know, I have rescued dogs that live with me, it is clear that they have some sort of equivalent of rationality and abstract thought and whatnot. You can't explain their behavior without positing at least equivalence. And I just was reading something in New Scientist this morning, an article that was, I think, in May in the New Scientist about supposedly uniquely human traits, mental cognitive traits that are present in non-human animals. Now, you know, I think that there are some very good arguments that there probably aren't a lot of differences between us and them. But let's assume that for the purposes of argument, we say, well, you know, there's a big difference between our minds and their minds because we use language and they don't, so their conceptual structures have to be really different. And the answer is, yeah, okay, I'll concede that for purposes of the argument. My response is, so what? They're sentient, they feel pain, they have an interest in not suffering, they have an interest in continued existence. And so I think that, you know, there are differences, but there's an important similarity. Now, if what you're asking me is, for purposes of treatment, how do I think those differences play out? And the answer is, well, let's assume that, you know, we link moral value with cognition. I don't think we should do that, but let's assume we do. We have situations, we don't treat everybody, we don't treat all humans equally. I mean, you know, we don't compensate somebody who's a brilliant surgeon or, you know, a talented musician or whatever the same way we compensate somebody who is working at a minimum wage job, and we allocate resources differently. We don't treat a person who has normal mental faculties the same way that we treat somebody who has mental disabilities, who has a mental disability. I mean, if someone's severely mentally disabled, we might not want to give that person a driver's license, or we might not want to accord that person certain privileges or certain rights or whatever that we accord to people who don't have that disability, simply because there are compelling logical reasons for differential treatment. But for the purposes of treating someone as chattel property, for the purpose of treating someone exclusively as a means to the ends of the rest of us, I would argue that the brilliant surgeon and the severely retarded person are equal. In other words, I would say they have the exact same moral claim not to be used as a forced organ donor, not to be used as a subject in a painful biomedical experiment, not to be used as a slave or whatever. I mean, for those purposes, they're equal. So, you know, is there a difference between, you know, a dog and a human? The answer is, yeah, sure there are, you know, yeah. And I'm all in favor of not giving dogs driver's licenses, and I'm not arguing that we ought to give them scholarships or give them the right to vote, although we might be in a better political situation if we did. I'm not saying that. I am saying, though, for the purposes of treating me or the dog as a forced organ donor or subjecting us to pain or treating us as a thing, I say my claim is the same as the dog's claim. You shouldn't treat either of us that way.
Back in 1978, when you went to the slaughterhouse, and most of your writing that I've seen, you don't use sort of the visceral, gruesome examples that some animal rights groups do in terms of demonstrating the circumstances that a lot of farm animals live in. But if you'd gone, let's say, rather than going to a slaughterhouse, I mean, if you'd gone to some kind of, you know, the bucolic farm that we imagine where the, you know, the animals are left free to roam and they're all very happy and all of this, even though, you know, in both cases the animals are going to be killed, but they're living very differently. Do you think that would have made a significant difference in your thinking and how that developed if that had been your model? And obviously it's not for how we eat meat in this country, but if it had been, do you think that would have made a difference it developed?
I don't really think that there's such a thing as the bucolic farm. I mean, there are some places that are less intense than other places, and there are individuals who may have a couple animals, you know, on their property that they use for their private purposes. But as a general matter, commercial operations have been pretty bad for a long time now, and you know, some are better than others, but they're all really horrible. So I would probably not, even if in 78, have visited a bucolic farm. I clearly would have seen it as different. I mean, well, remember something. What I went to was a slaughterhouse. I have been to intensive places. I have been to intensive agriculture places since then. But what I went to originally was a slaughterhouse. And if you are buying meat, whether those cows were raised in a less horrible setting than the cows that are raised intensively or the chickens that are raised intensively or whatever, they're all ended up in the same slaughterhouse, and the slaughterhouses are hideous. I mean, even the ones that are considered to be the best among them, they are all horrible, hideous, nightmarish sorts of places.
I agree with you that certainly, you know, the vast majority, the percentage of animals that are raised like that is insignificant in this country, certainly. But, I mean, just as a theoretical construct, is killing the animals alone, if you're going to kill them at all, no matter how they're treated, is that completely unacceptable?
Yeah, I don't think we have the right to kill. I mean, that's the I think, you know, you've actually put your finger on something that I think is extraordinarily important from a conceptual point of view. From a sociological point of view, you have identified something, and that is, we generally tend to think that animals don't care about whether we kill them. They just care about how we treat them and whether, you know, they want to be killed painlessly, but they don't really care that we use them. They only care about how we use them. And I think that's wrong. I mean, I think that's a cultural perspective that we have about non-human animals. I think that's wrong. I think that animals, anything that's sentient, remember something, sentience or the ability to feel pain is a means to the end of continued survival. So to say that an animal is sentient but doesn't have an interest in continued existence is, in my judgment, you know, I don't even understand what that means, because, you know, the sentience is not there as an end in itself. The sentience is there. It's a characteristic that certain beings evolve. you know, they have nervous systems, they have benzodiazepine receptors, etc. They evolve these characteristics in order to survive. Some, you know, fast food chain says, well, we're going to buy our egg from suppliers that provide more humane eggs, which I think is nonsense anyway. I don't think those eggs are any more humanely produced as an empirical matter. But, you know, they say these things. And then the animal organizations get all excited and give them awards and promote eating at, you know, the fast food places, etc. And I think that's obscene. I really do. I think that's crazy. I mean, yes, it's always better to do less harm than more harm, but that doesn't mean that the lower level of harm, assuming that it is a lower level of harm, and I would argue that it's not, but assuming that it is, that doesn't imply that the lower level of harm is morally justifiable. It doesn't at all.
Gary Francione, I want to thank you for coming on the show today and sharing this very interesting viewpoint.
I thank you very much for having me.